I thought to depart from the usual practice of speaking and do it all in semaphore and mime this morning. Not joking. We've been on holiday for the week and it's been fantastic. I'd like to say it's great to be back, but frankly, I'd rather be there. But while we were away, having a really good time, and my computer died, so here I was thinking I need to change my sermon and update it and upgrade it, and the computer died and I couldn't do it, so I had to do it on scratchy little notes, which I was up till midnight, or after midnight last night, putting into my new revised sermon. I had one prepared before I went, but often the way is that when you're musing over it and thinking through it, God impacts you and says, don't want you to talk about that. Talk about these other stuff instead. Which is always a bit frustrating when you're on holiday, because you think, I haven't got time to do this now, God. Can you perhaps give me all one download later? But it doesn't happen like that. So we'll see how this goes anyway. I'm hoping that God will severely lead me into through this. We've been looking at Thessalonians, as you know, so Thessalonians or that place in Greece, in Macedonia, where Paul and Silas were on the second missionary journey to. They've been in modern-day Syria, and they decided to have a visit to all the churches that previously started in the first missionary journey. So that was in what you'd now call Turkey. So they set off and went through these various places in southern Turkey, and then they wanted to go into the more westerly part of Turkey, but the book of Acts says that God prevented them from doing that. And then they tried to go to the north part of Turkey, and it says God prevented them from doing that too. So that only leaves them like the northwest corner of Turkey. So they went there, and they planned to go to a different place. But while they were thinking of what to do, God appeared to Paul in a vision, and it was a vision of a Greek fellow, a Macedonian, saying, "Come over here." So Paul took that as leading from God, and they decided, right, we'll do that. So they set off from Troas, and headed over into Macedonia. Now, Macedonia, just north of Greece, it's a separate country now, and it was a separate country then from Greece, but in between, a few hundred years earlier, obviously it had been the hub of the Greek Empire. You know, Philip of Macedon, who sort of unified Greece, came from that area. So, and Macedonia and Greece were the hub of the Greek Empire, as you might think. So they went to into Macedonia, and actually that was where the gospel came to Europe. You know, Macedonia's on the outskirts of Europe. It's come from Turkey, which isn't in Europe even today, and never really has been, and it crossed over the Bosphorus, part of the Aegean Sea, and into a few Greek places. Neapolis, and then Philippi, Phippolis, Apollonia, and then Thessalonica. I can't get my tongue around that. Thessalonica. Anyway, so the gospel of Christ came into Europe through Paul and Silas, and they had with them Timothy, who was a young man, and they picked him up en route from one of the southern Turkey churches. So, by that time, the Greek Empire was a thing of the past. You know, it had been and gone. And now was the Roman Empire. So the Greek Empire had been around for a few hundred years. It had peaked, and then it had died down, and then the Romans took over. So you could say, well, the Greek Empire just came and went in a flash. But actually, in many senses, it's still around. It's still around, and it's been a hugely influential empire, as empires go. Lots of empires have been and gone, and they're not really influenced us at all. But all of us here today are influenced by the Greeks. As a friend of mine used to say, I know a little Greek. It's got a kebab house on Eccles New Road. But the Greek language, you know, the Bible, New Testament's written in the Greek language, most of it. And 200 to 300 years BC, all of the Old Testament was translated into Greek. And it was called the Septuagint. The Greeks have given many things to the world, not least their architecture. Since we've been thinking about Greek architecture, Kath and I, everywhere we went you can see Greek columns. And they have these big triangular things over the tops of porches. The word porch, portico, isn't it? Might be Latin. But they're everywhere. Even lovely buildings are spoiled by having Greek stuff stuck on. And it's, you know, Britain's one of the worst offenders. We're doing it all the time. Some horrendous buildings in London that are in the Greek style. Not many of them are very pretty. Politics, you know, we get the Greek form of government thrust upon us, whether we want it or not. Nearly every country in the world has a Greek form of government nowadays. Sport. The Greeks invented sport as a national pastime and dedicated professional athletes. We don't do that nowadays, do we? Oh, yeah, we do. Yeah. Mathematics. There's been hundreds of Greek mathematicians. They didn't invent it, but they had some very influential men. Who knows Pythagoras' theorem? Come on, show of hands. Yeah, nearly everybody. Well, three, four. Religion. Well, they didn't invent religion, obviously, but they had a form of religion similar to the Roman religion. Their myths and legends, they're legendary, aren't they? They're legend, proper legends. Philosophy. They're great thinkers. Invented new ways of looking at life and at the world. And a lot of that has stuck with us. Many of their mathematicians were philosophers. They were thinkers, and they thought of mathematics as a religion, a way of thinking about the world. Pythagoras, who I mentioned, he was a whole school of what they call the Pythagorean school grew up after him, and they believed that God had created the world with mathematical simplicity. So, you know, you take a guitar string and you stretch it out and you make it half as long or twice as long. What do? You change the pitch of the note, and beauty is seen in the mathematical simplicity of the length of the notes, of the wires. And nowadays we do it all the time with guitars and fret distances. They're mathematically tuned to give you the right sound. Pythagoras noted this and concluded that the whole world, the whole universe, was devised and designed by God with mathematical simplicity. And everything in the world could be explained by simple numbers and ratios of numbers. And all those kind of numbers are all called rational numbers. You know, 1 over 2, 2 over 5. They're rational numbers, fractions. One of his followers, however, unfortunate man. I've already skipped ahead to lose my place. Hippasus of Metapontum. Presumably that's Hippasus of a place with loads of bridges. He was a follower of Pythagoras, and he came to an very unhelpful conclusion. When you think of a right-angled triangle with the side of unit 1, both ways, isosceles. What's the length of the hypotenuse? Well, it's the sum of the squares of the other two sides. So it's it's 1 plus 1 square rooted, root 2. And they thought, hold on a minute, that's not a rational number. They invented irrational numbers. Anyway, because they were they believed that God had created the universe in simplicity, you couldn't have irrational numbers, so they solved that problem by chucking him overboard on a boat visit, and thus was the end of Hippasus of Metapontum, because of his religious dogma had been overthrown by root 2. Some other notable Greek thinkers, Empedocles, he came up with the idea of four fundamental elements: fire, earth, water, and what's the other one? Air. Fire, earth, air and water. Fire, air, earth and water. That idea has persisted until modern times. In the 70s there was a band named after it. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Euclid, loads of famous Greeks. Socrates, remembered more for how he taught his Socratic method of question and answer. Plato, student of Socrates, founded the Academy in Athens, probably the first university in the world, and trained people from all over the world in the Greek way of thinking. And Aristotle, a student of his, who wrote more than 400 books. And he was invented the empirical way of studying life, you know, setting up ways of formulating a theory and then testing it out. A modern scientific method. It's still with us. We do it all the time. It's the way we normally think nowadays in the modern manner. We think we're modern. This was invented 2,500 years ago. Yeah, well, 2,300 years ago. Anyway, it takes weeks to go into Greek philosophical backgrounds, thought and belief, but the conclusion, or one of the conclusions of this sort of the birth of study and the growth, huge growth in knowledge, was that they thought of the higher senses, of what we think and believe, as being very important, and what we do with our bodies as being much less important. So, you know, they were thinkers and philosophers, although some of them were athletes, obviously. They had quite a gap between the brain and the body in their thinking. And such that it meant that you could do more or less what you wanted with your body, and it didn't really matter. But because as long as your brain still functioned, you could have your religious thoughts, your intellectual thoughts. But your body, well, that was something different. It didn't really matter. It was a lower and baser thing. And so they routinely had affairs. They routinely had prostitute work in the worship in the temples. Prostitutes were involved. And they didn't bother about that because they had this thought that the mind was elevated and the body was base, and it didn't really matter what you did with it. A bit modern, I'd say, that way of thinking. Also, their society was built on modern grounds, modern ways of doing stuff, ways that the British Empire was built, having loads of slaves to do all your work, servants and slaves. 2/3 of the society was workers, 1/3 was intellectuals. And the Greeks were all the intellectuals, and the workers were all slaves brought in from other places to do all the hard stuff. Bit like us with Eastern Europeans doing all the jobs nobody wants. You know, we go to hotels for your holiday, Eastern Europeans serving you. That's the way it was then, it's still like that. So the Greek man, the intelligent man with his brain, he could get on doing his thinking, and he could let other people do all the hard work and work out, you know, do his cooking for him and his cleaning, while he was able to get on with his thinking. And that's the world that Paul took the gospel into when he went into Greece, when he went into Macedonia. The Greek way of thinking and the Hebrew way of thinking, they were quite opposite, really, very different, and they'd had a little bit of interaction a few hundred years earlier when the Greek Empire invaded Jerusalem, and the Antiochus IV, who was a Syrian Greek, after the Greek Empire split up, he took over and imposed Greek lifestyle on Jerusalem, and it was horrendous. And they introduced pig sacrifices in the temple, and they introduced temple prostitutes, all sorts of horrendous things, which to the Greeks they would have thought, well, that's normal, that's what we do, we're Greeks, we're intelligent people, modern men, and that's what we do. And he imposed it on the Jews, and they hated it. It was completely opposite to the Hebrew way of thinking. And it still is. It's still opposite to the Christian way of thinking. But actually, we're largely influenced by it. Very largely influenced by it. They're at odds with each other, those ways of thinking. When Paul continued his missionary journey after Thessalonica, he went to Berea, and left Silas and Timothy in Berea, and he went off to Athens. So he went down south into Greece proper, what he called Achaia, which is the bottom bit of the peninsula where Athens was, and Corinth and places like that. And we pick him up in Acts 17, preaching in Athens, and he found that the Greeks were just sort of stood around all day discussing things, debating things, and they had debating chambers. And it says so in Acts 17, it should be explained that all the Athenians, as well as all the foreigners living in Athens, seemed to spend all their time discussing the latest ideas. And that's a Bible verse. It's explaining the Greek mentality. And later on in that, when they heard Paul speak about the resurrection of the dead, some of them laughed in contempt. It's alien to the Greek way of thinking. The gospel is alien to the Greek way of thinking, to the modern man. And we're still Greek in our thinking. Don't think that Greece died out 2,200 years ago and we've all got proper way of thinking now. The way we think is Greek. We are built on this succession of Greek philosophy and the way they think. It's the way we think in Britain. We're a Greek nation. The Romans took over and didn't really change the way of thinking. And then the Roman Empire fragmented, and Northern Europe was one of the kingdoms that came out of Rome. We've been birthed in it from a long time ago. We are Greek in our thinking, and we are not Hebrew in our thinking. Bear in mind that the Greek Empire sprung up during the 400 years when God stopped speaking. Now, God didn't say anything. There were no "thus says the Lord" for 400 years. The second batch of 400 years in the recorded history. The first one was when they were in Egypt. Yeah, and then this 400 years, in between the two testaments, the New and the Old Testament in our Bibles, God didn't say anything. And the Greek way of thinking sprung up during that time of absence of God. And it's still there now. Fortunately, the Jews eventually overthrew the Greeks and kicked them out of Jerusalem and to the Maccabeans. But we didn't get rid of our Greek thinking. Anyway, I'm eventually going to get round to my topic for today. 1 Thessalonians 4. In Thessalonians, after I'd done my study, I thought, why did Paul talk about these subjects? Why? The passage basically splits up into three chunks, verses 1 to 8, verses 9 to 12, and verses 13 to 18. And it's about living to please God, living a lifestyle to please God. Verses 1 to 8, you could say, let's live to please God in the way we live with each other. Let's live sanctified lives. Let's not do things that offend each other. Verses 9 and 12 is talking about living well within society, having people think well of us, working with our hands, not being busybodies, minding our own business, looking to live peaceably. Very good things, aren't they? I mean, that's what we all want, that's what I want, those verses. I want to live peaceably. And verses 13 to 18 is about a subject that continues in the next chapter. It's about the return of Christ. It's living a life that Paul was referring to, looking forward to our great Christian hope. And our great Christian hope is what? It's the resurrection of the body. It's not the Greek way of thinking where our spirit goes off to live in heaven and our body decays in the grave. That's the Greek way of thinking. The Hebrew way of thinking is that God would resurrect our body and we would live in our bodies on the earth. So that's the third part of chapter 4. And see how alien it is to our way of thinking. We've grown up thinking, I'm going to heaven. My spirit will live in heaven. Well, yeah, temporarily we are. That's not false. Temporarily we are going to live in heaven, probably, unless Jesus comes back before we die. We will spend some time in a waiting room, as it were, in heaven. But the purpose is that we get a new body. The body matters. It's not about the spirit and the mind. It's about the spirit and the mind and the body. All of us together. We are. What part of us did Jesus save? Did he save our intellect? Did he save our spirit? Our soul? The soul, our soul, when God breathed life into Adam, he breathed life into the body that God had made, and the body became a living soul. The body is part of it. We think, oh, our body's not really that important, I'm looking forward to getting rid of it. You've been dragging me down all these years. That's the Greek way of thinking. We don't talk about the basic functions of the body in British society, in polite society. We don't talk about it. You never see movies where they go to the toilet, do you? It just doesn't happen. We don't talk about those things. They're base. They're not elevated. They're not where our brains are, our spirits are, where our thoughts are. They're base things. We don't talk about them. So we've picked up this Greek way of thinking. I'm told that Hebrews do talk about things like that. I don't know if that's true. Is that true much? But I've heard people say it is true. And they have prayers about the body that we tend not to, because we think of it as being too base for us to think about. But the resurrection is going to be the resurrection of the body. It's a newness of life. Well, we're not Greeks. We're not Greeks, but we think like Greeks. And we should think more like Hebrews. So there's my message. I think I'll have brew now. We tend to be massively influenced by our society, of course. So Psalm 1 says, the first of the Psalms tells us the danger of society. And it says, blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful or scoffers. But his desire is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He's like a tree planted by waters, etc. So we are influenced by our society, those that we live amongst. And our modern society is basically been going on for 2,000 odd years. It's Greek in thinking. in thought. We have very similar thoughts to the way they invented it back in Plato and Aristotle's time, Socrates. The Christian faith is the opposite of it. It's very different. Of course, all the Christian faith is built on the Hebrew faith. And the Old Testament was done and dusted before the Greeks ever got out of nappies. It was, you know, God had written his last thing down before the Greeks even started. Before Philip of Macedon and Alexander the Great, and before those great empires. God had said his thing, and he got a big full stop at the end of it, saying, I've concluded my thoughts. All this stuff that come afterwards, the work of the devil. And boy, did he go to town in our thinking. The Christian faith is still under threat from the Greek way of thinking. And we're under threat now because the Greek way of life is the modern way of life. And in our country, laws are being acted that wouldn't have been out of place if a Greek guy had come up with it, or a Roman. So we live in a society, but we're not to be to have the standards set by society govern our thinking. The church and our faith are under attack all the time in this society that we live in. In parts of the world, large parts of the world, the Christian faith is under attack and people are physically killed. Here it's not so much physical, but it's in our brains, in our minds. The battlefield is in our mind, but it's on the subject that is covered in our passage. And matters such as the role of women in the church, the role, the place of marriage, men and women, physical relationships, those things, they're under attack. Gay rights, the nature of marriage. It's interesting that Tim Farron resigned last week, just before I went on holiday. He stepped down as leader of the Lib Dems because of the issue of gay rights. He kept being asked when he was campaigning, what do you think about gay rights? And as a Christian, he had particular views on that, biblical views, and he found himself at odds with the society around him. He couldn't hold the Christian views he held and stay in the position he was in. So is it possible nowadays to be a Christian and be in politics? Can we live in the right way nowadays with the modern way of thinking? Well, I've already said, it's not a modern way of thinking. It's been around 2,000 years and more. It's always been like this for quite some time. Homosexuality, Sodom was destroyed for it. When was that? More than 3,000 years ago. Well, about 3,000 years ago. 3,000 years ago. God destroyed Sodom because of that. It's not modern. It's not new. I feel sorry for Tim Farron. I didn't know him and never really noticed him before. But I feel he's like a brother that we've... And he's gone the way that we might have gone. We might have been in his position had we been at the front line like he was. It's for our... It's for us at Mount Chapel and what I'm doing today, speaking about the Christian faith. We're to contend for the faith that was once for all handed down to the saints. Well, it was handed down to the saints, like St. Paul, who wrote this letter, and the other apostles. They wrote these things, and we're to contend for them. That is the faith. It's not the Greek faith, it's the Hebrew faith. It's a faith that says the body matters. What we do in our body, it matters to our spirit. You can't live as if it doesn't matter. I mean, I've been trying this for quite a few years. I've been just eating whatever I felt like, doing as little exercise as I could get away with. And the conclusion of that is when you say, well, I'll educate my mind, I'll elevate my thoughts, and I don't care too much about what happens to my body. The conclusion is, sooner or later, they diagnose you with a disease, and you have to do something about it, because the body does matter. And we can't just say to God on a Sunday morning, pray for me, I've got a disease and I need God to cure it. Because I've been doing this to myself. You know, I've been doing to my body what I shouldn't have been doing. I've been abusing it. Eating stuff I shouldn't be eating. Putting things in it. Jesus said, of course, it's not what you put in the body that really counts. It's what's already in you that's evil, that's sinful. Nonetheless, you can't just abuse your body. Your body matters. You may notice I'm 30% less than I was last time I spoke here. No, it's not 30, 15. I've lost a bit of weight. And hopefully that'll continue. Because the body does matter. We need to take control of our bodies, our lives, not just our spiritual life. Our spirit is influenced by our physical body. That's not to say that God can't heal me. God could take away my diabetes with a stroke. I'm sure he could. But then I'll be back next week saying, can you cure it again? Because I've been abusing it all week. I've had cream cakes. I've had cooked breakfast every day while we've been on holiday. Gorgeous. But I've botched my calories. I've been good. And have we had chocolate? No, we haven't. Because the body matters. Is it too base to talk about the body? Yeah, I think it has been. Romans 12:2 says, don't let the world squeeze you into its mould. Well, the mould is the Greek way of thinking. The mould is the way that says it's what you think and what you believe that matters. What you do doesn't really matter. Of course, what you believe and what you think will eventually influence what you do. And if you think, my body doesn't really matter because I'm getting a new one, then you'll abuse it. If you think it doesn't really affect, if you think I can have illicit relationships, I can have affairs, I can entertain prostitutes, and that doesn't affect my spirit, well, sorry, it's not biblical. It does affect your spirit because we are not mind and body. We are mind and body. We are a united person. And God has saved our soul. He's saved all of us, not just our spirit. He's not just put a new bit of him in us, and that's the bit that matters and the rest doesn't. All parts of our life need to be affected by the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that's why Paul wrote to the Thessalonians saying, stop the immorality. Let's stop having prostitutes. Stop having affairs and girlfriends who aren't your wife. That was the Greek way of doing things. That's what they did. It's the modern way of doing things too. But it's what they did in Greece. I imagine that he had a number of occasions when he had to tell them these things. And it's not just Greece, it's large parts of the world. You know, Africa, we watched a program recently. And all of us probably will know most of the works we sponsor in Africa, what are they? They're orphanages, aren't they? Mostly, in the main, Christians are involved in orphanages. Why are they involved in orphanages? Because all the parents have died through AIDS. Why have the parents died through age? Because they have immoral relationships outside of marriage. They don't stick within the marriage bed. They play around everywhere. And the spread of AIDS has been completely let go. Free reign. Thousands and thousands, probably millions of people have died. And the Christians obviously are underpinning those innocent children, helping them by doing orphanage work. Some of the people we sponsor are doing that very thing. Nowadays, there are drugs, of course, that you can take courses of drugs now that stop all the symptoms of AIDS and stop you passing on the AIDS, HIV virus. So you can do it with impunity now. You can carry on your lifestyle and it doesn't matter anymore because people won't get AIDS. So you can sleep around as much as you like and it won't matter. Well, it does matter to your spirit, because body and spirit, we are joined. We're joined at the hip. And God says, if you join yourself with a prostitute, then there's some mystical link that I don't really understand, but we are linked to those we sleep with permanently. We are linked to Christ. 1 Corinthians 6, Paul wrote to those in Corinth, another Greek church, and said, the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. Our body is therefore for God. It's not for what we feel like doing. Oh, let's have a creamy Claire for lunch. Have we got any? Can we have that? Well, I could do that under control, but we will. And Paul said, I will pummel my body and subdue it, lest after preaching to others I myself should be disqualified. We take control of our body for Christ. We don't let it have free rein. That's the plan anyway. That's the theory. The practice is that we do that. The practice is that we say no to things that are harmful. Not be enslaved by any of them. Back on the subject of marriage briefly. Where do we get our views? Psalm 1 said, we don't get our views from society about these things. We can't trust society. Where do we get our views? It's from the law of the Lord. If we don't want to be influenced by Greek thinking, or modern British thinking, if you want to call it that, it's the same thing, then we need to immerse ourselves in a contrary way of thinking. Where do we find that? We find it in the Bible. Some people have called our church a well-sexist church. Some people in our church have regarded us as that. How can we be judged as being sexist or well-sexist except by comparing us with some other standard? You know, here's the allowable standard of sexism, and Mount Chapel is up here. We're well above it. We're well sexist. If we'd have been down here, we would have been non-sexist. Setting up a standard, who sets up the standard? Well, society sets the standard. But reality is, we haven't got to pay any attention to societal standards, because they are the world squeezing us into its mould. What we want is to know God's standard. What does God say? What does Jesus say about marriage? Well, fortunately, he answered the very question. The Pharisees in Matthew 19 came to him, tested him, said, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife and marry for any reason? And he answered them, have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female? And said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then, they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. They carried on asking questions. Why then did Moses give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? Jesus said, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. So Jesus said stuff about marriage, about sex inside and outside of marriage. He was not very modern about it. He referred back to the earliest times, the earliest teaching on the subject. First thing almost said in the Bible about people's relationships was that, and Jesus referred to it. And it's not out of date in Jesus' mind. It doesn't go out of date. It's eternal, eternal truths don't go out of date. We think, oh, surely such things are out of date now in the modern society. We think we're in 2017. Well, what's different between 2017 thinking and Sodom thinking? Very little. What's different between what was happening in Thessalonica or Athens and what happens in Manchester? Well, very little, actually. Quite similar. It's not modern. It's nothing to do with modernity. It's to do with sin. It's to do with immorality. It's to do with living your life with the dichotomy between what you believe and what you do. And thinking it doesn't really matter. I can do what I want during the week. Saturday night I'll get myself in order for Sunday. Get myself ready so I can be strut my stuff on a Sunday morning. Everything confessed, everything dealt with. No, it's not like that. That's not the way God wants us to live. He doesn't want us to spend Friday and Saturday confessing and getting right. He wants us to live the way he wants us to live. If you can't cope with, if you're not married and you feel you need to be married, get a wife, or you're a girl and you want a husband, well, go and get one. Get a proper one. 4 verse 4 says it's that a man should possess his own vessel in sanctification and honour. And it means get your own wife and treat her well and live with her properly. That's what it means. It means don't think you can go up to the temple and engage prostitutes or go into Manchester and engage prostitutes. It's not unheard of in the Christian church, I can tell you. It's one of the reasons I don't like being in church leadership, is you find out about stuff that you wish you didn't know. And you'd rather not know. You really would. Believe me. Possess your own vessel in sanctification and honour. The word translated possess, it means to get, to acquire, to win for, to purchase, to win mastery over. So if you want a wife, go and acquire one. Get one off the internet. It doesn't say how you get one. It just says get one. I'm not suggesting that getting a Filipino wife or a Russian wife over the internet is the correct Christian way of doing it. But it doesn't matter so much as how you do it. Ask God about it and then buy one on the internet. No, the point is, various ways of getting a wife or a partner, they're acceptable. God doesn't lay down a rule of how you do it. It's all right. Within certain bounds, we can do what we want. We have free will within the will of God to do what we want. We're on an ocean liner, and it's going from Southampton or from Cork, where we were to the other day, Cove, the port at Cork, to New York. God's in charge of driving the ocean liner, but we can decide whether we sit on the deck chairs or go and play pool or billiards or go and have a drink in the bar. We have freedom within certain bounds. Doesn't make any difference to the will of God. The ocean liner is going to New York. But we have freedom within certain limits. God doesn't say how you get a wife. He says, but once you've got one, treat her with respect. Treat her with sanctification and honour. Temptation is all around us. There's no avoiding that, I'm afraid. That is the nature of life in the human form. We are tempted. We will see things around us. We will hear things. And you will, and I will, we will be tempted. Even Jesus was tempted. It's not a sin to be tempted. But it's what we do with it. What did Joseph do when Potiphar's wife kept coming on to him? He fled. Fortunately, he was fit and young and he could run. Woe betide you if you're overweight and can't run. That's also true. That's also true. So which are you going to go? Fat and undesirable? Fit and desirable? No. Let's try and control the way we live and flee sin and immorality. Our body and our spirit, they're not opposites. They are united. We are joined. We are a whole person. We can love the Lord our God with all our body, soul, spirit, mind, all those things. Trying to separate it out into packages is a Greek way of thinking. And I've tried to do it. I've tried to think, how does the mind work? Where does the will come in? Where's the conscience in all this? And try and do some sort of model diagram of how it all fits together. Well, the way it fits together is we've got a lot. It's all in us. And we have to live with that. Body, soul and spirit. All of us united to follow the Lord. 1 Corinthians 6 again. We were bought at a price. Therefore glorify God in your body. And in your spirit. Which are God's. So Paul is saying the body is important. In some way we do not perceive properly our body and our spirit, they are completely joined. And Christians were already completely joined to the Lord. Our body is his body. Our spirit is part of him. We are part of his body. If we don't listen to this kind of teaching, if we think it doesn't really matter, I can do what I want, nobody will know, well, God knows. God knows. God is not mocked. Whatever we sow to the body, we will reap. If you sow cream buns and jam tarts, you know what you'll reap. You'll reap diabetes. I have. I'm getting rid of it. It's going. Not having it anymore. But that's what we've reaped. I've got two or three other ailments that are weight related. It's my own fault. Because I've left myself unchecked. And I counsel you, don't leave yourself unchecked. Keep your body in fit order. I got on my scales this morning. And it tells you things like your metabolic age. I've dropped 10 years while I've been on holiday. 75 I was last week, I'm 65 now. Actually, I'm only 61 physically, I've got a bit to go yet. I don't know how it works that out. I'm sure it's complete tosh. But you think, well, yeah, that's good. That's good. Healthy living. I'm coming back into order. Put on 4 pounds, but yeah, that'll come off this week. We should aim to walk properly toward God. And toward God means treating our wives well. It means not having rampant physical desires that are unchecked. Because they affect our relationship with God. As well as our wives. Surprise, surprise. It affects the way we live in our family. The other Greek thing, there's two other passages that are mentioned, two other aspects of Greek thinking that Paul addressed. One was sexual immorality. And the second one was to do with work. The Greeks stood around all day talking idly about the latest thing. Well, we do that, don't we? And we hope that we can afford other people to do the work for us. I've had people working on my house while I've been away. It's nearly done. Fortunately, I'm paying them. It's legitimate to pay them for their efforts. But it's not belittling to work with your hands. In fact, Paul says here we should work with our hands. Bricklaying and setting bricks and all that kind of stuff. It's a legitimate pastime. When Paul had nought to do, sorry, that's not the right word. When Paul had no support when he was in Athens and in Europe, he worked with his hands. He made tents. He was a tent maker. He went to Corinth after Athens. And he met Priscilla and Aquila. And they were tent makers, so he joined with them in their tent making business and supported himself, which is good. What is going on here? So, working with your hands, it's an aspirational thing for a Christian. You should think it's good enough for Jesus, it was good enough for God. God spent 6 out of 7 days working and 1 day off. Jesus spent about the same, 30 days working with his hands, doing carpentry, 3 years, I mean, not days, and 3 years preaching, walking around. Why do we think it was all right for Jesus to spend 30 years working with his hands, but not for us? Oh, it's beyond me. I'm too good for that. Rubbish. We should work with our hands. It's the right thing to do. We should aim to walk properly before God, before others, and in society. I haven't really got time to talk about the bodily resurrection. The next passage covers some aspects of that. John, if you want, you can talk about this bit as well. Just to say that we are looking forward to a physical resurrection. And our new bodies, they won't be ghosts, they'll be things you can touch and feel. And Jesus, in his resurrection body, ate fish. He also walked through walls. I don't quite understand that, but it was physical, it could eat. It was spiritual also, it could walk through walls. And we'll be getting bodies like his body. I'm looking forward to that. But people will recognise us, I think, and we'll look a bit like we did now. Hopefully we'll look like we did when we were 30, and not like when we were 60. I was at proper proportions when I was 30. And I will be again. But let's remember that the Christian way of living, the Hebrew way of living the opposite of the Greek/British way of living, is that we honour God with our bodies. We honour God with our spirits. We honour God with the work of our hands. All those things, they're united. They're not separate. We don't elevate one above the other. Right, let's just pray, shall we? Father, thank you. Thank you for giving us bodies. Thank you that we have been given flesh and blood. It's a gift. We couldn't live in this world without our bodies. Thank you for them. Sorry that I've abused my body so much. And I'm getting my just desserts. Here I am speaking about pudding again. Father, help us to live godly lives. Help us to live in ways that honour you. Help us to live in ways that honour what you've given us. You've given us that body, this body. Help us not think it doesn't matter what I do. It's what I believe that counts. It's not. The teaching about adultery was not about thinking about adultery. It was about committing adultery. It was about what you do with your body. Help us, Lord, to live with body and spirit joined up and living in a unified whole way, wholesome life, so that we'd honour you. Amen.